This is Eat Out In. Well, my guest tonight on Eat Out In is one of the most influential chefs of his generation. Korean-American chef David Chang has made Asian food in the West hipper and cooler and more egalitarian. His Momofuku restaurant empire has spread from New York to LA, Canada, even to Sydney, where he opened Momofuku Sibo at the Star Casino way back in 2011. Well, he's written a memoir, Eat a Peach, about his tumultuous life in restaurants, growing up as a Korean American, and his struggles with his mental health. And I'm delighted that David is with me on Nightlife. Hello, David, and thanks for joining me.
An honor to be on this program. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Hey, well, first, can you tell us how COVID's been treating you? What effect has it had on you and your life and your restaurants, obviously?
You know, it's been tough, obviously, but it's been worse for many others. So I'm fortunate that I'm still here, I'm healthy, and that's all I can ask for. And most of the people around me have been healthy, but for the most part, it's affected America terribly, mainly because we have horrific leadership that obviously hasn't handled the crisis nearly as well as Australia or any other country for that matter. So it's obviously affected the restaurant industry, and that I know. Obviously we have a restaurant in Australia as well, but it seems to upended life as we know it around the world, but specifically, you know, certain businesses such as the hospitality industry have been incredibly exposed as very fragile. Where everyone's figuring it out as we go.
And so tell me, what's happened to your restaurants in the United States?
Well, for a while, we had shut them down, the mandatory quarantine. We shut them down, I think, before most people, I think, even on our own accord. And we spent most of the first couple months trying to accumulate enough information about creating the best in practice safety protocol. We couldn't do anything other than be prepared. So for protective gear from masks to how you handle food. And we made that public and, you know, sort of figuring out how we were going to reopen. And currently most of our restaurants, even though some of them have reopened as they are in Australia, Sydney, Momofuku, Seibo, Toronto, Las Vegas are dining in right now. But New York City specifically, because of the density, is not conducive for dine-in. Mm-hmm. So that has really affected us. And we're pivoting and we're trying to figure it out, doing takeaway, doing delivery, doing groceries, online classes. We are really focusing on doing consumer product goods, something that we've had planned for about 5+ years. We didn't plan on launching a lot of it in the past 6 months, but obviously the pandemic has forced us to sort of consolidate what we want to do in a 5-10 year period in 6 months. So, you know, we're doing everything we can to keep afloat.
Yeah. I mean, the restaurant and hospitality industry are extraordinary in their ability to adapt and pivot, you know, in crises. And I have been amazed at how well that they've been coping, given that they've been hit by this almighty tsunami that COVID-19 has presented to their industry. So it is extraordinary to see what all the restaurants are doing given the situation. So it's good that you're still managing to, you know, get stuff out and, you know, do the best you can in the situation. Getting to your memoir, Eat a Peach, David, you've written this memoir, you know, it must have been a fascinating process when you are still relatively quite young to have to look back on your life and write this overview. What was the experience like for you?
I'm still trying to figure out how to articulate and express it because it certainly was something that I thought was going to be more of a business strategy handbook. But when I signed on to do this, it's something I guess I blocked out of my mind. I didn't really tackle the actual idea of a memoir till about 3.5 years ago. And it's been a strange process. You think that every part of your life will be in a book and it'll be like the definitive record. But then that's not the case. You actually still have to make it somewhat linear, somewhat edited down, and not every story, right? Not everyone or more than one person would even care about such things. So,
yeah.
You know, it was really weird to go back in time and to like find the different perspectives and then to put them in the words. So it was painful and at times cathartic and at times joyful and all the above. It was a range of emotions.
And what was it like revisiting your childhood? Because you had a fascinating childhood growing up as a Korean American in Virginia. What was that like?
You know, when I started out, I remember saying, we're not going to talk too much about my childhood. And, you know, even the process of writing the book, things changed. And you know, working with my psychiatrist, you know, over that 3.5 year period, sort of coincided with me actually having a lot of breakthroughs that I had had a hard time understanding, particularly all the things that happened to me as a child. And my relationship with my father and being Korean American in a mostly predominantly white culture, not fitting in with the Korean immigrant scene either. So there were plenty more stories, and I wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to just be stuck in talking about my childhood. So we hand selected a few points to sort of carry the trajectory of the book. But you know, it's never easy. I don't know. It's a work in progress, right? Me going back and understanding it. I have a better understanding than I do, say, again, when I started the book. But you know,
it was tough. Your childhood was tough.
It was tough. Yeah, childhood was not easy.
Hmm. There was a fascinating story I didn't realize is that, you know, you played golf as a small child, and not only played it, but played it really well. You were somewhat of a child prodigy.
Yeah, but you know, that's, speaking of a tough childhood, it wasn't something that I wanted to do. You know, golf was forced upon me. You know, it's not a sport I enjoy playing too much. And, you know, I spent most of my childhood days playing golf competitively, from say, you know, for about 7-8 years, from 5 to say 13 years old. So it taught me a lot. It taught me about failure. It taught me about competitiveness, but ultimately, you know, when you think about who you are, you almost never want to blame your childhood, right? You don't want to be this stereotypical, you know, Freudian analysis. But the reality is, at least for me, so much is explained because of my childhood.
I mean, it's hard, isn't it, growing up in an ethnic family when, as you said, you're part of a larger group and you want to prove yourself, your parents want you to do well and be successful. There's a lot of proving and meeting these expectations.
Absolutely. And it's not just America. I mean, I basically spent almost 2 years in Australia, and I've spent a lot of time traveling throughout that country, and I love it so much. And the one thing I've always found fascinating about Australia, it is in some ways very similar to America, in other ways not, but where it is similar, it's a country of immigrants. And it's what makes the Australian food scene so vibrant and diverse. But also, you know, you can see how it's natural for people to sort of find their values in similar cultures and in the countries that they come from. And it's natural to do that. And, you know, it's hard for people that are outside your bubble to ever truly understand what that's like. And, you know, that's hard on the parents, the first generation immigrants. I think it is also difficult for the kids because they have to bridge, you know, living in America or Australia and simultaneously having a path to their parents' country. And I think that's easier said than done. It makes nice books. It makes nice novels about the movies, you know, about the immigrant experience. But at the end of the day,
to actually live it is tough.
It's so hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine moving to another country and not speaking the language, and the country you're fleeing from was ravaged by war? That's tough.
Yeah, lots of challenges. So that was problematic for you. School was pretty difficult from your stories in the memoir. You weren't really sure where you fitted in, what your pathway was. You decided to go to Japan to teach English. Why that move?
Because I was a terrible student, number one. And I overindulged in partying too much in college. So that was more important to me than hitting the books. And I mean, I was very much about fleeing anything, right? And at a moment's notice, I would not like run away, but I would run away from my problems. I would run away from growing up and not able to get the jobs that I wanted in college. I remember going to the career fair, and it was literally the first table when you entered the door at Mather Hall at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And I didn't really know what the hell I was doing. It was just, hey, you want a job in Japan? And I said, sure. I like traveling. I want to be abroad. Maybe I'll be an expat. And there was no rhyme or reason. I just signed up. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it is so I didn't have to explain to everybody for the following year, what are you going to do after you graduate? Mm. I just say, hey, I'm moving to Japan. I didn't really think about what the hell I was doing.
Yeah, well, because it just sounded like you knew.
Yeah.
So when you came back to the States, and now you were discovering that you were quite drawn to food, and you set up this first restaurant of yours, Momofuku Noodle Bar, in New York's East Village. And surprisingly, given this, you know, relationship you had with your father that was fraught with a number of issues, he actually backed you and gave you money to set it up.
He did. He did. I mean, I calculated that it would have been about the same amount, at least in America, for graduate school. And I was about 26 at the time, and nobody knew anything about me, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing then either. And I was in a really bad place mentally. And the last person I ever wanted to ask was my dad for help, and he wound up getting a loan from three of his friends, and something that I didn't know anything about. And obviously, thankfully, I paid it off, but you know, my father was an interesting person, and he recently passed, and he was able to justify how he was as a person because he was, you know, very much a proponent and believer in the ends justify the means. And for him, it was his entire goal, how he expressed love, wasn't by showing love in the traditional way. It wasn't about saying, I love you. It was a hard love. It was, there was no words expressed, or no affection was expressed. Mm. But how he expressed it was something that was tangible, something that had eluded him in Korea and as an immigrant to America, and that was providing financially. And he worked his butt off and leveraging everything to basically attain a upper middle class, or, you know, higher end middle class by the end of his life, sort of financial status. And he came from nothing. He literally had like $20 in his pocket when he came to New York City in 1963. So, you know, he comes to this country so his kids will have a better future. And he had a single-minded track. So that's something I've had to reckon with and to understand about my dad, was that's how he expressed his love. Mm-hmm. He didn't know any other way. And I would rather have had it every other way than that. But that's the one way I know that my siblings always talk about our late father was – he was always there to help you financially. And he found a way to put four kids to college and do all these things, but all the work and how he raised us was an ends to the means for the financial sort of backing.
Mm. Well, it was extraordinary that he came through when you needed him at that moment, and you set up that first restaurant, and over these, you know, last couple of decades have set up the extraordinary phenomenon that Momofuku is right across the world. I wanted to ask you, you talk very openly about your struggles with mental health and your bipolar prognosis. How did that affect you while you were running your restaurant? So that early stage, when you first discovered how serious this condition was, what effect did it have on the restaurants, on how you dealt with your staff?
You know, that was my depression was one reason why I was able to open a restaurant, is because I didn't care. You know, it was either I take a dark turn, it was a binary option, or I do something that I'm not supposed to do. Either way, there were things I wasn't supposed to do. And I chose the one that was opening a restaurant with very little experience and know-how. And in some ways, that was like just a one-way ticket, right? And I didn't know what I was doing. And if I wasn't suffering from depression, if I had, you know, more of a normal tendency, I doubt I'd even be in the cooking profession, mm-hmm. let alone opening a restaurant. And, you know, for the most part, I think people think of me as loud and obnoxious, which I can be, but I think my default setting is to be a wallflower, to be, you know, quiet and to be reserved. And opening this restaurant allowed me to, in some ways, actually kill me, which was my old me, right? And I began to learn someone else. And I just was like, I don't care anymore. I'm going to do all these things that I never was able to do. In some ways, very similar to how, if you ever had someone that was diagnosed with a terminal illness, they all of a sudden start living life. Mm. And that's sort of how I can justify or explain it to people. It's an over reduction, or, you know, it's not necessarily like that clean and simple, but I just was like, it's all going to end anyway, so who cares? And every day I worked and lived like it was going to be my last day. Mm-hmm. And And that can be wildly effective, as it turned out. But it can also be incredibly damaging, both for my own sanity and health and those around me. I was woefully underprepared for the challenges of being a boss to people.
Well, you talk about, you know, that your workaholism almost, your obsession, and how hard you drove yourself, but also how hard you drove the people around you.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the cruel twist of it all, is I spent my life trying not to be my father in every possible way, running away from who he was. And I can talk about my dad in similar ways, because for me, when I wound up having a business that didn't collapse in the first 6 months, because we almost went out of business several times, and each time it felt like we just dodged a bullet. And next thing you know, we changed our goals. It wasn't about staying in business. It was providing healthcare. It was providing benefits. It was doing all these things that, you know, I thought was the right thing to do. And we worked so hard to get there. And it was about, everything was about, in my mind, to sort of be selfless. And, you know, upon reflection, and this isn't even in the book, this is just shows you how much I've had to reflect upon everything. You know, we touch upon it a little bit in the book, how I realized, or at least my siblings realized, you're just like dad. And I've never embraced that. I've always just blocked that out. What's dawned on me after I've written this book and after quarantine and being able to reflect and talk to some former employees, they think of me the way I think of my dad. Right. I treated some people like my dad treated me. And I know that feeling. And in my mind, when I had to think back about nostalgia, it's all positive. But when I talk to other people, they're like, no, that's not how I feel. You were a bully. You said things that were terrible to me. And that hurt, because I hold myself accountable and I should have been better. And I, you know, and this is all new for me to see that. I'm really mad at myself that I didn't see this before, because I've been working so much at this. And for me not to see that, I was so mad at myself. Obviously, I'm very hard on myself, but I was mostly disappointed, because how for the life of me could I not see that I was repeating the mistakes of my father to the people around me? And that's hard. That's really hard to see.
Well, staying mentally and emotionally well in the restaurant and hospitality industry is difficult, isn't it?
It's extraordinarily difficult. And I don't know if the world will ever understand if you're not in the business. And I don't know why anybody would quite want to be in the business. But the way I describe it is this, and this isn't even a close approximation, but when I try to explain to people how you're supposed to remain calm, cool, and collected, and some people do, I obviously did not come from a background, nor, you know, from how I was raised to the schools I went to and the kitchens I worked in. One reason I was sort of attracted to, not necessarily attracted, getting yelled at was how I learned, you know. Everywhere I went in my life, getting yelled at was how that was the norm. And, you know, I thrive in really pressure-filled situations, which is ironic, because when it's not pressure-filled, I'm anxiety-ridden. I'm the last person anyone would think would do well under pressure. And I'm not cool, calm, and collected. I just grind it out and I find a way to make it work. And the best way I've been able to describe to my wife and to people that want to know a little bit more is, like, when you're at the market or the grocery store and you see some parent, whether it be a husband or wife, and there's two or three kids, and you see them, you know, there's like three angles. They're walking through the aisle, and one person sees them talking patiently to their kids as they want candy. They want this, they want that. And they're just screaming and they're just running around and they're very patient, right? Another person at another angle at a different moment sees this same parent yelling, being like, stop it. You know, we've all seen that in the store, right?
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? We can all empathize. Everyone's like, oh man. Sometimes you see it, there's like two reactions. Wow, what a good parent. I can't believe they didn't freak out. The other reaction is like, wow, what a bad parent. I can't believe they freaked out. And then, you know, you don't realize that maybe they're freaking out because they never freaked out before, but maybe that their partner is in the hospital, and maybe that there's a fourth child that has leukemia, and their car got towed, and they have to make dinner. And, you know, you need to start to use your imagination, be a human to understand, like, nobody really wants to act that negatively.
Yeah.
And it takes time to sort of imagine. And in a kitchen, there's everything that can go wrong every day goes wrong. And you have all these employees, you have critics, you have bills to pay. Everything is ephemeral and everything's a war. And it's really hard to maintain your composure. It has been for me, and I know it has been for others. It's a perfect storm of stress.
Well, it sounds like the last couple of years you've gone through some very important soul searching, where this book has come from, David. With all the accolades that you and the restaurant and your restaurants have received over the years, and they've been everything from the Michelin stars to the James Beard Awards, what do you value most that you've achieved so far?
I really wrestle with that, and I hope that when I think about it, we've done more good than bad. We've added more positive. We've helped more people. We've been a net positive in our impact. And at the end of the day, too, you know, whatever we've achieved or whatever, it's certainly fine to think about, but it's all going to be forgotten, right?
I don't know. That the joy that I got the first time I had crack pie and the cereal milk ice cream, it's still with me, David.
Oh, that is great. Like, that's the goal. You always want to make people happy, yeah. Right? But when you really think about it, it's like, that becomes this platonic ideal that you're constantly chasing. And, you know, we chefs always want to over deliver on that. And I think we got to ask ourselves questions as to, like, how do you do that in a way that has work-life balance, that's not all out. And I don't have that answer, but when I think about the legacy or anything like that, I don't like thinking about that, because it's a very transient thing. Remember, like, anything you eat will be remembered in two ways. One, it'll go down the toilet, or it'll be remembered in good or bad ways as nostalgia. But you don't eat nostalgia. And that's the hardest part about this profession, is that every day, every meal is something that's new, and it could be good or bad. And you don't eat awards. You don't eat accolades, and you have to be present. And that's the hardest part. And I just don't think it's something that I need to get better at, appreciating what's happened. And I'm learning. I'm trying to be grateful and learn gratitude. But the hardest thing for me is to really understand what's happened, because obviously it's better for me to be in denial, because it makes me hungrier, makes me work harder. And obviously this is simultaneously the problem that I have.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've all been in various lockdowns and not been able to get to the restaurants that we love. What are you enjoying eating at the moment, David?
Well, I am in Los Angeles, and currently it's peak tomato season here. And, you know, Los Angeles is very similar to Sydney. And the tomatoes here are just unbelievable. I mean, the growing season for things in Southern California is outrageous. And one of the things that I've been able to cherish during quarantine, particularly since basically the beginning of May, and that seems to be how long the tomato season here is, this cherry tomato salad that I've made many, many times. We've had it on our menu at Noodle Bar. It's in our cookbook. And I think that's a recipe that I'm going to give you guys.
Oh, terrific.
And in the recipe, it's a sherry vinaigrette with soy sauce, a little sweetness, but you don't have to add shiso. You can. It's like a play on a caprese salad. You don't even need tofu, because I use a, you know, silk and tofu to sort of replicate a mozzarella. You know, these days I just slice tomatoes. I'll put whatever, if I have basil, great. If I have shiso, great. And I'll just put that vinaigrette on, and maybe even some stone fruit. And that's just a great salad. It's sweet, tart. It's got the umami from the soy. I can't recommend it enough.
Oh, it sounds delicious. Well, that recipe will be on the Nightlife website from David Chang, his tomato salad recipe. David, it's been such a pleasure for you to join us on Nightlife tonight. Good luck, and good luck going through this COVID period with your restaurants as well, and with the promotion of your book.
You too. Thank you so much for having me. Stay safe, and thank you for having me and supporting the book.
Absolutely. David Chang, chef and restaurateur, talking to us on Nightlife about his memoir, Eat a Peach. And you can get David's recipe for that tomato salad on our Nightlife website, along with all the other recipes shared with us by our Eat Out In chefs, from Rene Redzepi to Jamie Oliver to Maggie Beer. They're all on our Nightlife website.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.